First of all, I would like to welcome you if this is your first time, and welcome those of you who faithfully come each week. I'd like to welcome you back. We had a break last week, and but now we are back in full swing with a lecture each week through November 15th. It's the same time, 7 to 8, in the same place here in the auditorium each Tuesday. It's free and open to the public, with the galleries open until 7. I hope you'll take advantage of that as well. And that goes on through the run of the series. So take advantage and, of course, go up and see the Diebenkorn exhibition. If you would visit the website, or you can visit the website to check the schedule for the Tuesday evenings and to read about upcoming lectures and much more. There you will find information on next week's guest speaker, artist Jason Musson, a.k.a. Hennessy Youngman, with a link there to his website, which I feel really confident we'll have everybody marking their calendars to be here either out of admiration or curiosity or perhaps both. I think you'll understand what I mean when you visit the website. So you don't want to miss that. In addition, you will find that beginning this week, the annual graduate student lectureship program is scheduled at 6:15 each Tuesday prior to the lectures through October 11th. And if you arrive too late on a Tuesday evening for the lecture and you wanted to go to the hear the graduate students, you can find those also made up on Saturdays, but again, check that schedule because they're specially scheduled Saturdays with a repeat of each of the Tuesday lectures or presentations by area MA and MFA students. And the Saturdays are at 11 a.m., so check that out. The website is the best way to stay informed about what's happening here at the Modern, so I encourage you to make it a habit to check it out. As you know, Richard Diebenkorn Ocean Park series opened this Saturday to a very enthusiastic and large crowd for Day in the District and, again, for the members' reception Saturday evening. It was curated by the Orange County Museum, Museum of Art curator Sarah C. Bancroft, and co-organized by the Orange County Museum of Art and The Modern here in Fort Worth. This exhibition, which after closing here on January 15th, travels on to Orange County and then to the Corcoran Gallery of Art in D.C. It is the most comprehensive show to date of Diebenkorn's most celebrated body of work, offering a rare opportunity to explore in-depth the complexity of the artistic and aesthetic achievements within the Ocean Park series. This is work that can be read about and studied from afar, but cannot be fully appreciated without an investment of time, with careful and considered viewing, a thoughtful investigation of the artist's path, and the resulting history of a process that results on large canvases, works on paper, and even cigar box lids. I recommend the catalog. It's beautiful, with gorgeous reproductions and three very interesting essays from very different points of view. It will extend your experience in the galleries and be a lasting memento, but I must say, thanks to the recommendation of Sarah Bancroft, the curator, tonight's presentation might be one of the most valuable and unique opportunities for insight into the work of Richard Diebenkorn, and particularly the Ocean Park series, as Diebenkorn's daughter, Gretchen Diebenkorn Grant, has graciously agreed to share her father and her perspective of his career in this Tuesday evening's presentation. When asked for a bio for PR purposes and for my use for tonight's introduction, Gretchen insisted that all that mattered in this context is that she is the daughter of the artist. So respecting that, accepting that position, please join me in showing our appreciation and welcoming Gretchen Grant, Diebenkorn Grant.
Hello.
I have a couple of thank yous before I begin, because I have to say Texas has treated us very, very well. I also feel like I've eaten my way through Texas. I've been here a week. I would like to thank the museum here, which is a spectacular museum and a wonderful space for the exhibit, and Marla Price, the director, and Michael Opping, the chief curator, who worked with Sarah Bancroft to hang the show and get put together, Rick Floyd in the registrar's office. And I would like to have give a special thanks to Terry Thornton, who you just heard speak, and who is the curator of education, and whose really generosity went so far as to lend me the pearls off of her body. So I would look a little bit more respectable. Thank you very much. And up in the booth, we have John Knuckles, who's helping my husband, who I have a big debt of thanks to, who's running all the photographs for you to see tonight. Our staff in Berkeley of the Diebenkorn Foundation were all very supportive. In fact, I got a hysterical text from them tonight with all of their pictures holding up a good luck. I would like to thank them, particularly Daisy Coleman, who did put this PowerPoint together for me. Dick was on the road taking photographs of Diebenkorns from Toronto on down, and ending up in Texas. And so she did it for me, which normally he would do, and she did a beautiful job. So I just want to thank her, even though she's not here. This first photograph here is one of the family's favorite photographs of my father. It was taken in 1986 by Leo Holub, who is a well-known photographer of artists, particularly in the Bay Area, but also in California, but also all over the United States. And it is actually hanging in my mother's house now. It's a lovely photograph of him. It's the way I think of him. My father, who could be very articulate, was equivocal about speaking extemporaneously about art, his own or the work of others. I think he felt in some way trapped by the formality and the permanence of his words. I know what he means. Every time I thought I could put into words something that I know in my heart or my gut or my soul to be true about our life or about the way he approached his work or about the work itself, I began to say, oh no, that's not quite it. There must be a more subtle way of putting it. There must be a more interesting way of putting it, etc. So in some real ways, I am my father's daughter. He was a painter who loved and greatly appreciated poetry and music. I am an actress and singer, a person who loves words, music, and painting. He was a slow reader, so am I. The individual words, which are so important to us, I think, slow us down. I am often asked what it was like to live with a creative man, and in this case, a particular creative man, Richard Diebenkorn, who was not only an artist, but also my greatly loved father. What I'm going to talk to you about today is very personal, and therefore not necessarily what an artist valid in an art history context. So on the understanding that I am speaking to you today as a daughter, an admiring daughter, and not as an historian, I will shape some of my memories of my father with you. I should give you some basic background facts to give a context to what I'm going to say. He was born in 1922 in Portland, Oregon, where my grandparents had relocated temporarily from San Francisco. They moved back to San Francisco when he was a small child, and he went through the public schools in San Francisco and then attended Stanford University, where, to my grandparents' disappointment, he studied art instead of law or medicine. He met my mother at Stanford and married in 1943. I was born in 1945 and my brother in 1947, and my father died in 1993.
He always spent time drawing. He was an only child, and initially, I think this is from 1938, he was 15, 16. He was an only child, and initially, I think it was a way for people to keep him busy. His grandmother painted quite lovely landscape paintings, and she was interested in taking him to art exhibitions. She took him to see the first Van Gogh show in San Francisco when he was young, and apparently it was very sparsely attended. If any of you have been to a Van Gogh show recently, you know that that's really quite a luxury. My father is known for his sensitivity to the light and color of a particular place. I think it is no accident that many of his abstract pictures and even some of his representational ones are titled with the name of the place where they were painted. All these places looked very, very different. This first work that we're going to see is a student painting that he did when he was at Stanford in 1943 called Palo Alto Circle, a place that's familiar to all of the Stanford people in my life. Next, we moved to Sausalito, which at that time was the most affordable part of the Bay Area. That's certainly not true now. But it was on the other side of a bridge. It was difficult to get into San Francisco, so that's where we lived. And these two pictures were from Sausalito in 1949. Then my father decided to get his Master of Fine Arts and was accepted at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque, so we moved to Albuquerque in 1950, and we were there for 2 years. This picture here was actually in his master's show. In 1951 or two. then he accepted the only teaching position that he was offered, which was at the University of Illinois in Urbana. And this is the Archer. This is a painting that he did there. And then your lovely Urbana number 6, which is upstairs in an alcove just off of the Ocean Park exhibition, which I saw the other day, and I quickly added it to this because I think it's a lovely picture. My parents were not particularly happy in Urbana. I think it was a little too conservative for them, and they decided they wanted to go back to California. They missed the oranges and the light and the water, and so we moved to Berkeley. And this is an early Berkeley picture called Seawall. But you can still see there's quite a bit of abstraction in it. The next picture is a gouache, which is related to a lot of the paintings that he did during one group of pictures that were very much involved in landscape, sort of urban type landscape. And then finally, coffee, which is at the San Francisco Museum, which is pretty typical of some of the representational pictures at that time. In 1966, my parents decided that they were going to move to Los Angeles. And when they first got to Los Angeles, my father was continuing on with the more representational work that he had been doing. And then we see a rather dramatic change. Here's Ocean Park number 27 in 1970. The first picture was 67. This is 1970. Then we have an untitled collage, which is one of my particular favorites, which is 75. Then Ocean Park 122 from 1980. And finally, a work on paper, which is untitled in 1986. In the late 80s, my parents decided that they wanted to move back up to Northern California. And after looking for a year or two, they finally bought a place in the country about half an hour north of Santa Rosa in Sonoma County, and called Healdsburg. And they moved there in 1988. So this first is, as you can see, is continuing in the vein of the Ocean Park works. During all of the times that we moved from place to place, there would be a kind of a bleeding of the previous work. So even though this one is actually later than the one I'm going to show you next, it is hearkening back to the ocean parks of the LA period. This is a pretty classic subject for artists who are contemplating their own death. He was ill at this time. And you can see the Ocean Park influence, but there's also a little figurative, and then there's the historical reference. This is a picture that my mother would not allow in the house. But I always loved it, and I had a really nice conversation with him about it. So I've included it today. And then finally, this is a work from 1991, one of his very later works. And I sort of sense that this is possibly where his work was going. So you can see some of the influence of the really early abstract work, also the Ocean Park planar surfaces. And in a funny way, it also relates representationally to me somehow. So it's kind of a culmination of a lot of things. Some of my favorite memories of my father have to do with the way he taught me to see. I cannot look at certain places or certain things without thinking of him. There used to be a marvelous peeling brick building in Berkeley that he loved seeing. You were aware of the bricks underneath, the lavender color it was painted. It was owned by an Indian man. And in some places, the effect of the undercolor on what is now the top. There is a place where, as you approach the Bay Bridge on the way to San Francisco, you can see the water. And he would comment, as we were driving over the bridge, on the color of the water that day as opposed to another. This next work is called Chair Outside. This is from 1959. He taught me to see the variation of color within something that we would describe as green or blue, that reflection, shadow, worn places, dirt, etc., can affect the color we see if we look more completely and carefully. Though we think of a rattan chair as a model tan, we still recognize it when its colors are pushed or altered into a different spectrum. He was very taken with useful objects. By that, I mean a really well-made hammer, a pair of pliers, kitchen implements, or old, well-worn tools. He appreciated form as it related to function in a very particular way that interests me very much. Our life was organized around his life, and always was. When I first lived in Berkeley, we lived in a flat where the central room, the dining room, was his studio. He was not to be disturbed. Later, when we moved to a bigger house in Berkeley, his studio, which he built himself, was in the backyard, at least part of the time we lived there. I only remember knocking on that door once, some emergency. I was not afraid, it just wasn't done. My father had had his studio in the house a number of times during my childhood. One of my earliest studio memories is very vivid. I had just insisted, screaming, that my mother and I leave the movie The Wizard of Oz at the point when the very early on when the house fell on the witch. We went directly home and upstairs to my dad's studio in our house in Sausalito. And I don't remember being in the studio before this event. The floor was caked with paint. It looked like a Jackson Pollock painting. And there was the smell of paint and turpentine that I associate with my father to this day. He was working, but he stopped and spent some time explaining to me the difference between fantasy and reality. Then the next day, he and I returned to the movie, and I was able to make it to the end of the picture with great anxiety on my part. He was comfortable going in and out of fantasy. It was important to him that I understand this concept, and I do. I have used fantasy constantly in my own work, of course, and yes, I too am comfortable with it. This is Robo Bird. This is a drawing that he did with my son, for my son. I'm not sure exactly when, but probably in the mid-70s. As a grandfather, he shared much of his fantastic sense of humor and delight in images with my children. He carved pumpkins, made Easter eggs, drew with them, and generally shared his work with them as well as with the rest of us. Now, this dragon here was drawn also with my son. And when my father finished the shape of the dragon and did a few sample scales, he turned to my husband and he said, "Well, you fill in the scales." And that's why it's signed with both of their initials on the piece. This is Running Dog. This was a present for my son, which is huge. It's about 3 feet tall and about 5 or 6 feet wide. It's hanging in his dining room. It's made of tar paper and construction tape. And it has quite a lot of movement. I really like that dog. When my daughter was little, my husband and I made her a dollhouse, and when my father heard that we were going to do this, he decided, well, the dollhouse should have paintings in it. So these are the dollhouse pictures, and these are how they were inscribed on the back. And you'll see that the fifth one there is, it says Aegon Sheila and R.D. 1975, because that is a little clip from a magazine or a card or something that he had. The pictures are all pasted paper and very detailed and really, really lovely. I'm quite fond of them. He didn't like to shop, so when a birthday or Christmas came along, he and my mother would determine what was a wanted gift, and he would make a card. The tradition continues in our family. My son Ben makes delightful cards for everyone that are uniquely his, but reminiscent of his grandfather's humor. This first card, my husband and I were going to a trip to New York when we were newlyweds and didn't have a great deal of money. And this card was accompanied with a check. And in New York, we were to go to Bonnier's to get some replacement glasses. We were to go to Le Vaudor for dinner. We were to go to the Whitney to see the pictures. And other delights, which were unspecified. The next card, when I was pregnant with my daughter Phyllis, we wanted to have a rocking chair. And so my father did this drawing, which was accompanied by a check, and we bought a not nearly as fanciful bentwood rocking chair to have for my daughter. And then when our son began growing very fast and needed a new bed, my father drew this for him to get his new bed. When I was little, just what his profession actually was confused me. He referred to himself as a painter, but in my really early years, he also painted houses occasionally. Additionally, he taught painting. The fathers of my friends had quite conventional jobs, didn't have paint under their fingernails all the time, worked normal hours, and did recreational things on the weekend. Explaining this father of mine, who is definitely not easily categorized, was tough, especially when friends came over to our house and took a look around. These next two photographs are taken by Morley Bear, who was commissioned by the Oakland Museum to take photographs of my parents' house shortly before they left for Los Angeles. And so we have a whole series of photographs of every room in the house and all the things that are hanging around. The way our various houses looked inside was different from any of the houses of my friends. The furniture wasn't conventional. Much of it was designed and made by my father or found by him in junk stores. He particularly liked old wooden desk chairs. My parents and I now resisted curtains and drapes, possibly because of what one misses when the exterior view is obscured, and certainly also because of the resulting loss of light. This next picture, the couch in our living room, and I don't mean sofa, was covered in an Indian bedspread. And usually had our dog Valentine, and you can see Valley right there, sleeping on it. Our dishes didn't match, God forbid, but remember, this was the 50s, I'm mostly remembering here, in an era where everything, it seemed to me, was supposed to be matched. You know, sweater sets, purses and shoes, dishes, silverware, linens, furniture, cups and saucers. Nothing matched anything else in my house. Believe me, it was wonderful, but its differentness was confusing to me. My father changed what was hanging on the walls often. There were drawings and objects on every available ledge and piles of framed drawings and paintings leaning against walls. And then we get to what was on the walls. In my early years, they were hung with abstract works, and of course my friends would ask why we had things like that on the walls. They would inevitably point out that they could make something like that that was just as good or better. Later on, there were lots of drawings of nude women, and occasionally men as well. And of course, these drawings mostly resulted in averted eyes, or in some cases, covert glances. But in only very rare instances, any appreciation or understanding. My mother tells me that I went through a very long little white house by the side of the road phase, during which I longed to live in an ordinary house furnished with matching everything. That was a simple variation of the house next door and the one next door to that. But in our house, everything had a visual significance. This is a beer label. My parents, when we lived in Albuquerque, made their own beer. And what we would do is we would get in the car and drive down the deserted roads and where people would toss their beer bottles, and we would collect them all and they would sterilize them. And then my father would put his beer label on the bottles. My mother was an exceptional and very international cook. Meals were significant, delicious, and lasted a long time. There was no eating in front of the TV. We always ate together, except for Wednesday night, which was my father's drawing night. Every Wednesday night for years, he and Frank Lobdell, Elmer Bischoff, and later and early on, before he died tragically young, David Park, would hire a model, or sometimes two, and drew until all hours of the night. One of the most interesting drawing exhibits I remember seeing showed some of the drawings from these artists that had been grouped according to particular nights and poses. It was a bit like hearing the same story from three different observers from slightly different angles. It was like a Rashomon effect. Except for these drawing nights, he always worked alone in the studio. When late in his life, I worked for him as his secretary, he often received lovely letters, usually with impressive resumes attached, asking if the sender could be a studio assistant. Many artists do have such a thing, Sam Francis, for example, or Andy Warhol. But I was instructed to write and say that he worked alone, and the only presence he would allow when working was his dog, Amy, who you will see back there. His studios all shared certain characteristics. There was the aforementioned smell. There was, whenever possible, diffuse north light. There were lots of art books lying about and tools and, of course, all sorts of paint and materials on tables and on the floor that were in an order known only to him. In the figurative years, there would be Indian bedspreads to be used for the models. You'll see that there. And until late in his life, a large, very full ashtray. There would be things tacked up on the wall, some of which had to do with what he was working on, and others that were there simply because they interested him in some way. The chair where he sat when he was thinking and looking was consistent in later years from studio to studio. A black nalgahyde low armchair for which he had built a height extender because it was too low to the ground. There was also a black folding chair, which I don't see in this picture, but it's in a couple of others, an old wooden desk chair, and a large rattan chair with a cushion that appears in many of the paintings and drawings, including the one that I showed a few minutes ago with the slightly pushed warm colors with the blue background. For a palette, he used paper plates. There was lots of stuff on the floor, cutout paper, objects, etc., and many dust curls. The studio was never cleaned in any conventional sense. It didn't feel dirty. It just felt like his. Now, these next pictures are paintings that he did from in his own studios over the years. And the first few are what we refer to as the Triangle Studio, which is a studio we had in downtown Berkeley on a triangular piece of land that was raised when they built the BART system there, if any of you have been to that area. And it had this checkered floor, and it's in a lot of drawings and paintings from that time. And here's the studio wall, and there's that chair I was referring to, the black folding chair, which has been enhanced a bit with either a reflection or just a plain enhancement there in that picture. Here's the studio sink there, where he washed up. And then this picture is from his second Ocean Park studio, not the one that he built, but one that he used that had old windows that swung out. And I have always thought that this was a seed for the Ocean Park pictures, because the pattern that window made with the interior and the exterior and the action in looking through that space was reflected in many of the Ocean Park figures later on, including this next slide, which is the studio window, but definitely moving into the Ocean Park period. I do remember seeing him work a few times, mostly when I was quite young. He was very physically involved with the paint and the canvas. There would be a lot of contemplation and then an aggressive, active involvement with the work. His hands were strong, and when he painted, he used their strength somehow to express his ideas. He often drew at home, and I recall the same visceral connection to the paper, which was usually attached to a board, which he would have in his lap. Sometimes he was so physically involved that he would actually go through the paper. Then often an elaborate patch would result. If, as he was drawing, the proportion of the paper didn't seem quite right anymore, he would glue on extensions. So a lot of the drawings have these sort of odd measurements. They're not 8.5 by 11 or, you know, any of the standard pieces of paper, or many of them are just sort of weird. Sometimes, it seemed, the process of the patch or extension was important as the drawing itself. This next picture is Soda Rock, number one. Soda Rock is the street that they lived on in Healdsburg. This is all made of found objects from his walk. So there are gum wrappers and little pieces of tin foil and little pieces of other kinds of paper, and that's an orange juice carton lid in the middle. He liked things that had a past, which showed a previous form or a scar. He didn't erase much, but left pentimenti for contemplation. He couldn't always explain this to people. He had to add an extension in height to his entrance gate at Healdsburg so that the truck delivering his paintings could enter the property. His neighbor just doesn't understand why the extension was left unpainted. But my father liked the way it looked, and it is unpainted to this day. This is a picture that Hans Namuth took of my father drawing my mother in 1958. My mother was a terrific model. He would say, "Would you hold that position, please," as she was in conversation with someone, or reading, or smoking, or drinking a cup of coffee, or a glass of wine, and she would hold it in a lovely, lifelike way. I am still in awe. This is a painting of my mother that is at the National Gallery in Washington, D.C. I was not a good model. There are very few drawings of me. He said my qualities were expressed in movement, that I became dead when posing. Furthermore, I really hated it. Nothing like just having your father really look at you as a teenager. It's not a good thing. This next picture drawing is was originally purchased by the pianist Eugene Stoneman, and I've always found it fascinating that this drawing that looks so musical to me and so related to the piano and related to music in general was purchased by that man, and it always seemed appropriate. All artists share certain issues concerning the creative process. Although he wasn't formally trained as a musician, my father was very knowledgeable. His understanding of musical repertoire was incredible. He and my husband shared many late nights listening to music and discussing what they were hearing. My father and I had conversations comparing my worries as an actress that I would never work again, or that I didn't know how to begin work on a character, to his equivalent, the blank new canvas, particularly the first new canvas after a group of work was sent off to a show somewhere. An interruption had happened, not necessarily a bad thing, and it was time to start again. It was helpful to me that it wasn't easy for him, that he proceeded by using his will and his drive to paint. It may seem odd to say this, but I think he actually liked mistakes. Perfection wasn't high on his list of qualities to which one should aspire. He wrote a list of 10 notes to himself about beginning a painting that included these three observations that have a particular meaning to me. The first one is, do search, but in order to find other than what is searched for. The second is, mistakes can't be erased, but they move you from your present position. And the third is one that I have over my desk, tolerate chaos. I have some general comments about the way that my father worked. His subjects were primarily from memory. There are a few pieces that are actually called imaginary landscapes, but really nearly all his representational landscapes and interiors are from his mind. He almost never did preparatory drawings for a painting, but he often referred to or was informed by drawings or parts of drawings that he had made at an earlier time, or even that morning. Nor did he work from photographs, although in his things I have found newspaper or magazine photos that he had cut out because they interested him. Some part of the photo may appear in a gesture or a shape in a painting. And in 1970, the U.S. Department of Interior took him on a plane flight to do some aerial photos that are clearly related to what he was working on in the studio. Some of his related drawings are in the catalog for this show. It was a sort of pleasure to see them all laid out in the beautiful catalog that Sarah Bancroft put together. All artists change things. We know this because we have seen x-rays of paintings from the past that appear on the surface to be a single, confident choice. But my father was interested in the evidence of the changes that a work went through as it evolved. I learned about his values as a painter over time. When I had my first lead in a play, the director sent me a bouquet of roses. I wanted them to last forever, so being the daughter of an artist, I asked him to paint them for me. He explained that he didn't paint what others wanted him to paint, only what he felt moved to paint, and that he couldn't paint the roses. I was disappointed, but I understood completely because of the way he presented it. Imagine my surprise when I came home from school and he had painted the roses, a lovely colored drawing that I especially adore. I suppose because I really did understand that he couldn't be obligated to do it, my roses became a possible subject after all. He did a series of cigar box paintings, that many of which, there were 13 total, and I think there are 8 or 9 upstairs, These cigar box lids were done because he liked to smoke cigars, and people sent him cigars, and then he had these lovely boxes that they came in. And so he used the boxes. And these paintings, the cigar box paintings, were only given to friends. They were never sold until recently. They're all very, very special to the people who own them. For a man who appreciated the continuum and the interconnectedness of the history of art as highly as anyone I've ever met, my father valued his own autonomy very much. He didn't like labels. He resisted being a member of this movement or that movement. This very labeling, I think, sometimes seemed to cause him to explore some variant or new way of looking. Although it seemed that in some way the Bay Area became visually used up for him in the mid-60s, thus prompting the move to Los Angeles, I think also he may have perceived Los Angeles as having a broader variety of painting, that he would be one of many different individual painters rather than an abstract expressionist or a member of the Bay Area figurative school. He didn't think of himself as a California painter, but as a painter. He objected to being pigeonholed. He was a very opinionated man with a strong sense of right and wrong. He lived out his principles and he expected others he loved to do the same. He was not very good at compromise. I mean that in the positive as well as the more obvious negative sense. He was a combination of judgmental and discerning that was very complex. One of my favorite things that he said to me was in response when I announced that as a matter of opinion, he said, "Not really." We once had a conversation about the difference between nude and naked. I had chosen a drawing of a woman wearing nothing that is somewhat assaulting in its presence, as you can see. He pointed out that it was because she was naked, not just nude. Nakedness implied a state of actively impressing on the viewer her lack of clothing, rather than simply appearing before us unclothed. There was a specificity to the way that he thought. Obviously, a big issue for artists is when is a work finished? He was very clear on this subject. Sometimes things would be released in the sense that they were framed or even sold, but a bit of doubt remained. My mother once asked us to keep at our house a picture that was hers because my father was making noises that it was unfinished, and that's this picture here. Sometimes he would work on a picture later, and instead of making it better, he became less satisfied and then destroyed the picture. We hung my mother's picture in our living room. Every time he came into the room, he commented that something didn't quite work for him about it. This went on for years. Then one Christmas, the roast beef was out of the oven, the Yorkshire pudding was cooking. He asked my son to take the frame off the picture and to find him some paper, some paint, and some glue. He then cut out a shape in the paper, quite small really, painted it the lighter color he wanted it to be, and glued it over a similar but dark-colored shape in the upper left-hand quadrant of the work. So we're talking about this little piece right there. And it used to be almost black. He then pronounced himself satisfied. My son put the frame back together, and we sat down to Christmas dinner. He never brought it up again, and the picture was better. The first time I saw one of the Ocean Park pictures was quite a shock. This is a photograph my husband took. In 1968, my husband and I were visiting my parents in Los Angeles, and my father asked us if we would like to go to the studio while we were there. The last works we had seen had been representational. There is no sense from him that we would be seeing something utterly new. It was terrifying to me to be unable to comprehend what I was seeing. It is not only that the paintings were abstract, because we were familiar with his previous abstract works. I am really referring to the necessary mental visual vocabulary necessary to understand something unexpected and indeed unimagined. He was so patient with us. He probably enjoyed our shock and our loss of words. Gradually, as we relaxed and looked and stopped trying to place this work in any category, we began to see and to understand and ultimately to appreciate it enormously. It was a very special day. There were certain forms, shapes, and even themes that interested my father for his entire life. He was taken with the proportion of the golden section, which is the smaller is to the larger, as the larger is to the sum of the two, which is a Greek proportion. Many of the beautiful temples are in that proportion, and a lot of the Ocean Park pictures are in that proportion. Some of the symbols that derive from heraldry, such as the Maltese cross or checkered quadrants or diagonal quadrants, began to fascinate him, I think, when, as a boy, he looked at the Wyeth illustrations of King Arthur. Other recurring shapes are related to cards, clubs and spades particularly, playing cards, that is. And these spades, we'll go through them a little bit, and you can see some of the variations that he did. Ending with, not quite there yet, this, which is an Easter egg that he painted with my kids. And if you roll this Easter egg, there is a spade. And we've tried to make this photograph so that you can see what it is. So there's the top of the spade up there, and then the middle of it, and then the bottom. And it's a blown Easter egg. A book that I remember him showing me was an examination of artists' work that referred back to the work of other artists, themes and variations. In his own work, an early drawing of his marine jacket relates strongly to historical works of other artists and to his later etchings of coats ranging from realistic to abstract in the Aryan Press book of Yeats's poetry published shortly before he died. My father basically painted 365 days of the year. Really, he was always working because he was always looking and deeply noticing, even when he seemed to be doing something else. Recreation was basically uninteresting to him, so the ski trips and the trips to Hawaii that many of my friends experienced were not a part of our life. Of course, I actually was well-traveled because we drove across the country a couple of times, and my father took summer teaching jobs in Colorado and in Los Angeles, where we rented someone's house, and we had a new life for brief periods. But he went to the studio daily, as usual. He and my mother took several trips to Europe to see paintings there, to visit friends, and once as State Department emissaries to the arts to the Soviet Union. But even on trips, he looked in his particular way and sketched and did some etchings and sometimes even painted. I have had a hard time with the tenses while working on this piece. I continue to find my father very present in my life. I think of my father's work as a series of intimate spaces to which the viewer is allowed to enter and to experience. There is a sense of order in even his most chaotic works that calms me and pleases me at a very basic level. When he died, someone, and I wish I could remember who, said that he had a sense that my father had entered into the place that is presented to us in the Ocean Park paintings and drawings. That is where I like to think of him, too. This last work is a drawing he gave to me on my 30th birthday. I have been seeing it first thing every morning until it came here. It pleases me very much, and I miss it. Thank you very much for your attention.
If you have any questions, I would be happy to answer them insofar as I am able. So, anybody? Yes?
Was your father a contented and happy man?
Was he contented and happy?
Yes. Was there an emotional content? How much emotional content came into his, his color playing? How much it was just an exploration of space and color and form? And was he a contented man?
I think he was a contented man. He was a happy man. He was emotional, yes. He was very committed and cared about a lot of issues. And would be disappointed when that care was not reciprocated in some way. But yes, I would say, generally speaking, he was a happy man. Yes. Another question?
Yes. I'm recently been Googling the intersection of Main Street and Ashland in Santa Monica.
Uh-huh.
And I want, and maybe you can clarify the geography of that studio. It looked to me from the street views on Google that maybe that building is not there anymore.
No, it is there. The studio he built is still there. It is now rented to a designer, I believe. He moved out when he moved to Healdsburg and then rented the building. But it's still there exactly as he had it.
Is it at that corner?
No. It's if you know where Pete's is, it's across the street from Pete's Coffee. Does that help? Okay. Yeah. Anything else? Yes?
I'm just curious if your father was comfortable with the critical perception and eventual adulation of this series compared to critical feelings about earlier work. He seems like a man who has lots of ambivalence, so I'm wondering if maybe he was concerned that this would overshadow some of his very, very wonderful earlier work.
Oh, no, I don't think he thought that. But your question has some other issues that he did think about. I think he never expected to be recognized. I mean, he painted because he needed to paint, and he was going to paint regardless of what anybody thought about it. And I think he was quite surprised and a little overwhelmed by his critical success. In terms of critiques of the work, at the Ocean Park at first was looked upon as a mistake. So was the figurative work. When he moved into the figurative work, that was looked at by critics as a mistake. I can remember him saying, there's going to be a review and they are not going to like this, and indeed some people did not. But again, he didn't care about that. And, it would have been easy for him to stay on the same